Hello, Kiara. Is that how you say your name? Kiara?
It is. Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for the invitation to be here.
Good to talk to you. I note that the name Kiara, as I made a note of it, it's Italian, Irish, Hindi, Swahili, many things.
The story behind my name is I was born into at the time it was quite the scandal because I had Scandinavian Lutheran grandparents on one side and Irish Catholic grandparents on the other. And both my father and mother's sides, like the Lutheran married the Catholic, and then they had to baptize their baby, me as a Catholic, of course. And my parents both knew this sister, this nun who had taken on the name Chiara after Sister Claire, Assisi's sister saint, And one way of spelling that in the English is my name is Chiara, it's from the same root. Yeah. So I'm named after Sister Claire, actually.
Wow. But it's a very rich name. I mean, so many historical backgrounds to
It is. And, little did they know that I'd be interested in the work that Claire and Francis were doing there in Assisi way down the road. I'm
it. Yeah.
going to hide my self-view, Paul. I don't like seeing
No,
myself
no.
on the screen. There we go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking a little bit about your class. This isn't today's business, but it crossed my mind. Your what kind of class is it? Is it a theology class or a religion?
And I just saw Heather's last email, and I do not have to stop hard at 10:30. I have some time afterwards, so it's
Okay,
a problem
cool.
for us to chat about some of this too.
Okay.
It is a 200 level undergrad class that I developed here in at St. Olaf. I call it Ecology, Justice, and Christian Tradition, and it fulfills one of our general education requirements, which is called Christian Theologies in Dialogue, with the idea being that students encounter Christian theology, just like it sounds like, in dialogue with either another discipline or a question, or in some cases, it's in dialogue with another faith tradition. So, in our case, in that class, we're kind of thinking, well, our students are, I'm asking them to think about how have and how do Christian theologians, practitioners, think about all things Christian, not just theology per se, but ritual practice, all of that, in light of ecological concerns. And we, it's just so, I'm so excited because when we center the topic of justice in the course, the readings I've selected are curated with that question in mind. And so the day
Yeah,
you'll
that's an old article. I mean, I looked at it. I still believe it's true, but it's an old article.
I know it is, but of the stuff that's out there, I think your piece there is really accessible for undergraduate students, for one thing. And I like that it's dated because you were kind of making the case for why justice is so central at a time where that wasn't necessarily,
That's right.
agreed upon, or it wasn't as
It was sort of a fresh idea of all things. It's hard to believe now, but there
And so
were different schools, the political school and the ecology school and the
that's right.
wilderness school and lots, so.
So in that particular class period, I kind of want the students to get a sense of that, how eco-theology as a field has shifted and changed, and how and why there's been different conversations about the role of justice. And so actually on the syllabus, Paul, they read Bergman too, but I suggest to them, please read Santmeyer's piece first. And then Bergman's piece, because it's a little bit more chronological and you'll kind of get a better sense for the flow of the conversation. So, yeah.
Okay, maybe we could slide into today's business.
Sounds good.
Good. I've been focusing in my own mind, in my own efforts lately on grassroots and particularly things like Lutherans restoring creation and and what's being done with on the front lines, particularly with students and younger people. And one of the things that gives me a challenge to think about is, how do you really reach out to your students? I mean, what sort of questions are they asking about eco justice issues and things like that? How do you sort of think about those things?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm thinking right away, just this past Tuesday, I was with about 50 different students here at St. Olaf that are leaders of various environmental organizations on campus, and students that are have committed to a small program we have here called the Environmental Conversations Program. So these are students that are deeply invested in these conversations. And, you know, what I sense and what I hear from students is they are really eager to learn more about skills related to organizing. And they really want to be in relationship to frontline people. So, you know, an example of that here in Minnesota is we had a lot of students who were up in various encampments working with Indigenous leaders who were fighting against the Enbridge Pipe 3 line that unfortunately was completed in northern Minnesota. But I really see that students are, beyond what they're learning in their classrooms, are really eager to learn those skills of collaboration and organization. And it's really valuable and important for them to learn those from people who are like boots on the ground, lived experience. Yeah. And at the very least in the classroom, reading those voices and centering those voices is really important. Yeah, there's this generation, I think, has so much to offer us. When I say us, I identify as the generation, you know.
Now, you have written a very good book on vocation. And as we think of your students, how do you translate that that traditional theology, and especially since so many students today, at least that's my impression, are nudged toward college to get a job, you know, that's however much they may be engaging with real issues, especially a place like St. Olaf, where they're sort of nudged to do that kind of thing. Yeah. Nevertheless, in the back of their minds, is, maybe it's their parents' voices that they hear. It's just reality that getting a job is really important, but theology vocation is maybe something that includes that, but is much broader. How do you handle those kinds of questions?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say about that, Paul, is it really depends on the student, because, and I think context here really matters, you know, at St. Olaf, this incoming class, we have the most first generation students we've ever welcomed on this campus.
Wow.
We have, for example, and we have families. I have a lot of BIPOC students who have entire family systems that are supporting them, and first gen students that are supporting them in their work here. And I say that because for some of those students, the focus on the job is really important, yeah. Right? It yeah. has to be, because there's an entire network of people who are depending upon that student to succeed. And so I want to name that. I think conversations around vocation look different for different students based on their class location, their social locations. I know what I try to do, and I do teach courses, and I just talk a lot with students about vocational discernment. I don't always use that language, but yeah, I think you're right that there's this very kind of shallow understanding sometimes about, I have to somehow like hear from something or someone about what it is I'm supposed to do, and I have to figure that out when I'm 19 or 20, and then I have to take the right steps and land the right internship to get where I need to be. And so Holding that tension in place, that there truly are some students who really do feel a need to deliver on some things. I think
Sure.
I try to ask students to think about you're living into your vocation right now, because vocation is always place-based. It's always about where you find yourself. You're in relationship to a watershed, you're in relationship to the land you're on and the history of that land and the people who tended that land before colonial settlers came. You're in relationship to your other than human neighbors. You have an internal relationship, right, to yourself. There's work that you need, especially college students, like internal work that you're due to yourself. You know, you're responsible to yourself in that respect. So I really try to burst the bubble of like vocation isn't something down the road. It's not something that you're going to figure out. It's right now, and it's dynamic and it changes. And this is where Lutheran ideas of vocation can be really helpful, I think, in terms of priesthood of all believers. All people have a vocation because we have myriad different roles we inhabit, all of us, all the time. And with life's changes, those roles change. And so too our vote, the ecology of our vocation, the way those different roles intersect with each other change. And I just think that liberates some students to think about themselves, A, as having vocation and agency in that right now, and B, that it's not some static thing that they have to figure out, that it will change, just like our landscapes are changing and our relationships change. And so then the goal for us is to be discerning about and paying close attention to what is going on around me, and what is my call to responsible relationship. That's how I try to think about it as I'm talking to students and crafting assignments that engage kind of vocational reflection, that kind of thing.
One of the many unanswerable questions that we're all wrestling with is climate anxiety.
Yeah.
That is, here your students are now sort of taking hold of things with some excitement for the first time and learning and figuring out hopefully what their vocation is now and where how they're shaping this up, and yet they live in a world which is to use a theological term, going to hell in terms of especially climate issues. And a lot of people these days are significant number of people are talking about climate anxiety and how that's affecting people. Do you see that in your students' world? I'm sure you feel it yourself. How do you sort of engage these really heavy, unengageable big issues? What is your what steps do you take in that direction?
Yeah, it's absolutely a reality our students are facing. And pretty much in every class I teach, I take the opportunity to introduce, you know, Glenn Ulbricht's idea of solastalgia, or this idea that we are really living with the affective realities, like the embodied, it affects our even our body systems at the cellular level in terms of this anxiousness that we carry forward related to these things. And so Paul, I've been really shaped and informed by Joanna Macy's work, the work that reconnects on this, if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
She's a Buddhist philosopher who's been thinking about these questions for decades, really, at this point. And I think her model is really useful and helpful to us, because it in a nutshell just says, listen, we need to first acknowledge the anxiety and the pain, right? And name it, and give spaces for ourselves and our students to name it, name the anger, the despair. You know, I hear a lot of students talk about how they just feel like they weren't told the whole story, right? And then they start to learn more about kind of the
They
system.
weren't told the whole story.
Yeah, as they start to learn more about kind of the big systems that are at play that lead to kind of climate violence, for example, you know, it's on the one hand, really important and formative for them to learn about those things. On the other hand, it can feel really debilitating because how do I address this mammoth global, dispersive system, and so naming some of the feelings they have when they kind of awaken to some of those realities in a deeper way in their college years. But then I would say, and I think a lot of Indigenous thought is leading all of us to reflect deeper about this, that linked with that, naming the pain, naming the hard realities is to also lean into practices of gratitude and joy. And I would say, deep opportunities for students to feel and experience deep belonging, not just to one another, not just in a social sense, but also to place, is really an important thing to kind of hold in tandem with that. So, and that's something for all of us that we have to practice, right? Habits of gratitude, habits of joy. I just finished reading Ross Gay's book, The Book of Delights, where he just took a year to just write down any old thing that was delighting him. And it's a hilarious memoir, but that piece I think can help because there is, of course, theologically, I mean, I identify as a Christian theologian, there's so much to marvel at and give thanks for and just, be utterly stopped in your tracks due to the wonder and the beauty of our world. And so if we can hold and if we can practice and if students can grow in their practice of gratitude and paying deeper attention, in addition to naming those real embodied affective realities, I think that's a helpful, I try anyway to model some of that in the classroom and give them opportunities to practice those things. So when they graduate and they continue to live into these hard realities, they have a muscle, if you will, that they've sort of started to build to deal with the despair and the anxiety. And not that it's going to go away, but there's also, just beauty and the experience of wonder,
Yeah,
a lot of gratitude.
you self-identify wonderfully as a Christian theologian, and that presumably means that you show up in church from time to time. And working with your students, I mean, there's so much bad news out there that you're well aware of in terms of the Christian churches, particularly on some of the evangelical sides and the end of the world and denying even de denying realities. What sort of connections can you suggest, do you suggest to your students about dealing with these issues in a context of a Christian community, which is presumably also dealing with those things. I mean, it's the bad news is is that, as I say, that is much publicized, and many students, when I was a practicing college chaplain, there were the ex-Catholics, particularly, who just had so much baggage that they had to deal with. How do you begin to sort of open up for them who may be, alienated from their own churches about making connections?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's an interesting mix in my context, and I think just young adults I know in general, there's, we've all heard about the nuns, the non-religious, like students that just don't affiliate at all and don't want to affiliate with any spiritual religious tradition. There's certainly some, Paul, as you suggest, that are pretty jaded and have been hurt by their Christian tradition. I definitely have students who would identify as like recovering evangelicals. And so I guess part of what I see m as my responsibility is to bring us back to these rich, deep conversations that Christians have been having for centuries about the heart of Christian faith. And that is that the Christian God is a God of relationship. I think the language you've used in some of your books is the giver, the gift, and the giving, right? And I know we both share a love of Jürgen Moltmann's work, who's doing that, you know, is one of kind of the most influential Trinitarian theologians in my reading and in my life. And thinking about, if we think about God as relationship and we think about God's presence in the world as imminent, right? And that this is all about relationship. That can just be a really healing place for, I think, for some people who have to deconstruct some of the doctrine and ideas that they inherited. And I think it also can be a healing place for those who are just very distrustful of the church in general or any kind of organized religion, period. That I regularly hear kind of agnostic or atheist students say at the end of a semester, "I just had no idea there was such diverse, I you know, such a diversity of thought within Christian tradition, and I had no idea that there was such an emphasis on mystery and mysticism." And boy, my students love reading the mystics, Paul, you know, because so I think that those are ways where there can be space for healing, both for those who have been harmed and those who are just beginning to explore Christianity. Yeah.
Maybe ask you. This is a wonderful experience for me because I can ask questions that I've never been able to answer
Oh.
myself. But one of them is a small picture of it would be an early adolescent goes to church camp and has a wonderful experience and comes home and has to go back to the same old church, quote unquote. And then there's a college student who has takes your course and learns these wonderful things about vocation and place and the richness of native traditions and the richness of history, and then graduates and sort of has to look around, for a place of re-entry. How do you wrestle with the question of re-entry? I mean, after St. Olaf, what,
Yeah. I think if we're doing our job well here at the college, those relationships ideally are being built throughout their time here. And that doesn't always happen, but and by that I mean they don't have this siloed, separate experience in college where they really have opportunities to be in relationship with people outside this place while they're here, so that it doesn't feel like such a contrast when they
Like internships or
Yeah. And, you know, for those students who do identify with faith traditions, like really encouraging them to be a part of those communities while they're here and not just the on campus, for example, or yeah, just how they use their time in the summers, for example, I think is a piece too. But, you know, I think I mean, they're adults. We have this. We're in the first semester right now at St. Olaf, and we have this conversation just this week with first year students. Like, you're a college student now. You're an adult. Legally, we can't even talk to your parents about your education. You know. So, I think this relates to what you and I were just talking about with regard to vocation. Not seeing college as this thing that prepares you for adulthood. There's this scary transition, but like, you are living into your vocation right now, and you are an adult, and you do have things to contribute right now. And so this is just part of that journey for you. It's not, you know, it's not a side road, so, you know, a little trip down the way that you then need to get yourself back on the main highway with your life. It's part of that. And, you know, I hope students hear loud and clear that all of those things you explore, those interests that you don't, those rabbit trails that you don't know really where they're going to take you, they're not mistakes and they're not a waste of time. This is part of the problem with our lack of attention and rest and wonder, right? If we're if we're living into this hyper productivity mode that late stage capitalism does sort of promote, that we always have a reason for what we do and everything has to have a goal in the end, and that should ideally lead to a good paying job. Well, then there's just so much that's lost in that. So for students to understand that this is a time for you to explore, and hopefully you can craft a life that will also allow you to do that when you leave this place.
The part of the academic experience, as you are well aware, is coming to terms with the isms, like classism, on the positive side, ecofeminism, and maybe students are different these days than they were in mine, but my recollection is that they would try out certain things, like be a very passionate eco-feminist to see what it feels like, or be a Marxist, let's say, to see what it feels like. How do you sort of, as a teacher, try to shape those tendencies of really plunging into something, and yet you may be losing something because you're so passionate about that particular.
Part of that is developmentally normal with young adults, right?
Okay,
So
yeah.
I mean, we know that like the brain isn't done developing until like 26 or 27. And so that piece of like, I'm going to go all in and I'm going to identify in this way, is normal for the age group that I work with and on some level. So I try to keep that in mind, knowing that, next semester it could be something different, especially with students that I get to kind of follow through all 4 years. It's remarkable to see the things that they're passionate about and what kind of their focus is when they start versus when they graduate. A great point, a case in point is, I teach in environmental studies. I often get the first year student who's like, I'm a vegan. This is how everyone should eat. I've done all this work on kind of the relationship to food and climate change. And then I had a student who went and worked with indigenous people in the interior of Alaska and literally had to eat whale blubber to survive and learned from those communities about the importance of that. And, her whole mind, kind of her whole framework on food changed. So I take some of that lightly, not because I don't take my students seriously, but just because I know that they're in that time of life where there's a lot of trying things on. But then I think the other thing I would say, to how to encourage students to not just see their perspective as the only one is just the importance of dialogue. And this is tough in a cancel culture, right? This is tough in our contemporary context where you can set your social media up so you only hear people who have your same view. And some of our political leaders are terrible models of discourse and dialogue. And I think it comes down to, when I write a syllabus, that's a value statement. I'm showing my students my own values when I write a syllabus. And if I really hope I'm introducing them to a variety of voices on that syllabus where they'll read an eco-feminist, but they're also gonna, read a different kind of feminist, say, I don't think of this in the same way. An example there is some eco-feminists have a lot of problem with essentializing gender and using the term Mother Earth. And then there's some indigenous leaders that I have them read who very much want to own women's deep connection to earth. And they have different views on that. And so, I like to say isms, right? Where I ask, let's read about ecofeminisms because there's a lot of different forms of that. And we need to dig into the nuance a little more.
You are clearly in touch with a broad range of questions, and as I say, you wrote this very good book on vocation, and I'm wondering about your own vocation now. What are you working on? What would you like to be when you grow up? What are the issues that you're maybe going to write your next book about?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about you and your future.
What I want to be when I grow up is a really excellent mom and partner to my husband, Andrew. I have two daughters who are 11 and 6, and they are my teachers in so many ways, speaking of growing in wonder. And that's just a big thing that I think about day in and day out, how to do that well. Because especially with my kids, there's only so many years where I get to really have that time with them. But that relates to a more professional academic project. I definitely want to do some more thinking on vocation. I'm especially interested in H. Richard Niebuhr's responsibility ethic. Not a lot of people have taken that up and really thought in a more sustained way about applying it to our ecological concerns. I do that a little bit in the book, but I want to do more with that and think. I love your recent book, Paul, because it's so practical, and I think that ethics should be practical for our communities. So I want to do some more thinking with that. I have agreed to contribute to a new series on reconstructions in Lutheran theology that Paul Hinckley's putting together, and a team of other editorial scholars are putting together. And so I'll be writing a book for that series on how kind of ecofeminism and new materialist ideas might shape how we read Luther today, and especially thinking about kind of biblical anthropologies. What is it to be human, and how is science really challenging theological ideas of what it means to be human? So those are kind of, some of the academic pieces I'm working on. I really though want to share with you. I want to write a more popular book, or I really want to continue to think about childhood. And part of this is because I am a mom, and the spiritual wonder of children as it relates to access to nature. So I've written a little bit about this in the past. I read everything I can get my hands on this topic, and we have a lot of really cool stuff available to us on. We know about the biobehavioral benefits for kids to be outside, to not be in
Right.
screens, but there's not a lot out there about the spiritual benefits of that. And so kind of in a more popular way, working with caregivers and educators, I want to keep exploring that. So it's kind of two projects that will sort of be unfolding at the same
I
time.
see. I see. It, that is that speaks very much to me, as you can well imagine. 100 years ago, I wrote a little book from that drew on Erik Erikson and some others about development of basic trust in childhood and how important that is and as part of it. So I really encourage you in that. That
Thank you.
I would maybe want to bring this conversation to toward a conclusion and is there anything you want to ask me? I've been asking you all these questions, and I'm much edified and also gratified with your own vocation of teaching and where you're going academically. Anything you want to say to me?
Well, I So can we geek out with an academic geeky sort of related?
Yeah, sure.
I would love to hear your thoughts on how you frame kind of panentheism today in light of ideas of emergence and how science, how the field has kind of changed our ideas of origins of things. And I think you've offered in some of your work a good critique of certain forms of panentheistic thought, and I kind of wonder where you're at with some of that today.
I love the theological question. I had to cut to the chase. I am deeply informed by Luther's paradoxical theology.
Yeah.
I don't think that we know where God is. That and panentheism sort of gives us a picture that God is all around and everything else. Yeah, that's true from Luther's point of view, but it's not only God is the in with and under, but above, beneath, beyond. And so I'm taken by paradox as a theological methodology. There's not a lot that we know as theologians, and a lot of what we think we do know stands in tension or even in contradiction with what we think we know. And so I would rather stay pretty much close to ground in terms of our experience and the larger picture of panentheism, I think, is useful, maybe in part, but not only panentheism, but God is not here. Right. I mean, Luther will say God is totally absent.
Yeah.
I mean, and that goes with our experience in many ways. And so it's not, I have to be careful how I put this, it's not a, we don't live in a womb, but we live in a broken world where at the same things, God reaches through this broken world to take hold of us and to send us and to give us a vision and give us hope. So I like the theology of paradox, that you can say different things that sometimes clash with each other.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I'd prefer to go about responding to panentheism. Or I'm in a long-standing theology group in the Boston area, which Wesley Wildman, you may know that name, is a theologian of science and many other things, and they know an awful lot of things about God. They do. And I tend to want to be on the modest side and pick up what I can learn from the Bible and the tradition and try to sort of bring it together and help me take my next step. And I guess that's where vocation comes in, that theology really issues in vocation, and understanding is a struggle. We work with scripture and with tradition, and we try to piece it together and figure out what the next step is going to be. So my recommendation to anyone who would hear me would be under the rubric of theological modesty and not make huge claims.
I love what you just said, Paul, of theology as invocation, that it's like, it's the beginning place to continue to ask and wonder, and that does require modesty and humility. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Excited by your work. Keep me on your mailing list.
Okay, I will. Well, and let me just say thank you, Paul, for reviewing my book when it came out. You did that, and I just thank you for that. And thanks for the invitation to read Ecoactivist Testament. I am really excited. Your last book, I just think, is going to speak to such a broad audience of people. And I'm grateful that this stage in your life, you're taking time to do that work. It's a gift to leave for all of us. And
well, thank you so much.